Welcome to Between the Lines, a monthly magazine program on the third Thursday of every month at 2 p.m. on WGXC at 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. My guests today are playwright and blogger Brian C. Petty, and later on, Kenneth Hamrick, the artistic director of the Catskill Mountain Foundation, and Christina Lynch Markham, a dancer with the Paul Taylor 2 Dance Company, which has a special 3-week residency program and a performance of the Paul Taylor Dance Company on May 22nd at the Orpheum Performing Arts Centre in Tannersville, New York. But first, Brian Petty.
Tell me the truth, to burden your mouth for what you say.
Brian C. Petty is a supremely talented playwright, blogger, actor. Up until recently, he was best known for his many plays, including Banshee, The Measure of a Man, Next Year in Jerusalem, and Echoes of Ireland, won several prizes. But his new e-book, Sister Mercedes and the Temple of Doom, which is just out from Amazon, may change all that. It's a funny, real, offbeat, honest, human, opinionated, original, sometimes scabrous, but always clever look at life. And it's based on his blog, Petty Plays at WordPress. Sister Mercedes consists of a series of stories, beginning with his formative years as a fat Irish-Italian Catholic kid, picks up later when he's married with two kids and dealing with health issues, money problems, flooded basements, getting thrown out of his home, losing his job, and much, much worse. But above all, it's just wickedly and self-deprecatingly funny. But enough exposition. Let's hear from the man himself. Brian, welcome back to Between the Lines. You were on here about a year ago performing your play Banshee, and I've known you for a while now. But after reading your blog, I obviously know you a lot more.
I think the world knows me a little bit better, and I don't know if that's for better or for worse, but that's the way it is. I'm so glad to be back. Appreciate the opportunity. It's nice seeing you again. But yeah, here we are, and my whole life is in this 113-page e-book.
Yeah. How about reading us an excerpt?
I'll start with the very first one. It's called Sister Mercedes in the Temple of Doom. You can wonder where I got that title from.
Yes, where did you get that title from?
Well, Sister Mercedes was actually my principal when I was that fat Irish-Italian kid that you spoke of. This happened in the seventh grade. It was a huge part of my Catholic upbringing, I guess you could say. I think that pretty much sets us up for where we are. I had a college professor who once said, "Catholicism gives you something infinitely complex to rebel against for the rest of your life." Being a rebellious Catholic, I said to myself, "What the hell does he know?" Notice I didn't say it out loud. But as I look back at my 12 years of Catholic school, I have to say he had a point. No one taught me the true meaning of wretched, bilious hate better than nuns. In the 1970s, there were two reasons to become a nun: morbid fear of sex and latent lesbianism. I mean, if you didn't get laid during the summer of 69, what chance did you really have thereafter? I suppose there were some authentic brides of Christ, but in 12 years, I met precious few. Certainly not my principal, Sister Mercedes. That was her name, I swear. She hated me. A little background. I wasn't a troublemaker. Quite the contrary, I was boringly, stupefyingly good. Good grades, never caused trouble, barely spoke, actually. My younger brother, however, was an absolute hellion in gray uniform pants and a maroon sweater. A classmate of his was running full out to line up after recess, and my brother casually stuck out his foot and tripped her. Sister Jean saw this and responded as any reasonable adult in a position of authority would. She beat the hell out of him. A closed-fist, old-school, mass-in-Latin massacre. Amen, alleluia. My mother's cousin lost a promising high school basketball career in the 50s because a nun broke a yardstick over his calf. He was asked what he had done to provoke the poor woman. But the 70s were a more civilized, groovy decade. Nothing was bad enough to warrant an attack on a mere child, even though the poor girl did go sprawling headlong on the concrete parking lot, and by all reports, my brother laughed his ass off while she did. My father was not going to kowtow to the Catholic hierarchy, especially post-Vatican II. He went to Sister Mercedes and demanded that Sister Jean apologize to my brother, which she did, tearfully, in front of my brother's class. Sister Mercedes, like John Gotti or Tony Soprano, never forgot that humiliation and dishonor. She needed a scapegoat, or in more appropriate religious doctrine, a sacrificial lamb. Enter a fat, sensitive, seventh grader with pants slightly lighter shade of gray than everyone else's. We had to find them in the husky section, often in corduroy. And enter the Hobbit. I loved The Hobbit. I was one of those nerdy kids who actually enjoyed reading on his own. The Hobbit had it all. Dragons, dwarfs, elves, short creatures with hairy feet, a magic ring, no mystical pseudo-Christian axe to grind. I'm talking to you, Prince of Narnia. The fat kid with the ripped pant crotch was entranced. Christmas break ended and we were scheduled to take our Hobbit test. I was actually looking forward to it. The tests were passed out along with our Scantron answer sheets. No sooner had I raised my number 2 pencil than all the tests were immediately recollected, and we were asked to take out a piece of loose leaf numbered 1 to 10. We were then given 10 short answer questions, roughly along the lines of, what was Bilbo's second cousin's dog's name, and on what page did he appear in the standard Penguin edition? Two of my classmates, apparently, had stolen the answer key out of the teacher's cabinet and distributed it to every kid in the class except me. Such was my anonymity among my peers. One of the pilferers came from a family of 19 children that had such a squeaky reputation that nuns and priests would frequently genuflect in the presence of their mother. She barely noticed, busy as she was trying to avoid tripping over her own uterus. But I digress. The fuzz had caught on. The nuns had played the old switcheroo game with our tests, and waiting in the hallway to extract information from the defendants was Sister Mercedes. Within minutes, she had the kid from the big family awash in tears of guilt and announced to the class that because of his larceny, none of us would be having recess for a month, unless we had passed the 10-question sham test. Nobody did. I was the closest with 6 correct. While we were sitting inside during recess, relegated to whispered conversation, an idea occurred to me that I should have dismissed immediately and without any further internal discussion. The idea was, this is unfair. I know, right? Stupid, naive fatty. I tested the idea with my fellow classmates and found 100% agreement. Emboldened, I timidly ventured that someone should bring said unfairness to someone's attention. This time I was soundly congratulated not only for my otherworldly perceptive abilities, but also for possessing the courage, nay, the hubris, to attempt such discussion with so formidable an antagonist as Sister Mercedes. Excuse me, what? I was volunteered by popular demand. In short work, I had become their voice, their hope, their backbone, their unwitting fool. I sucked in my substantial stomach and asked my teacher if I could speak to Sister Mercedes. The dear woman tried to talk me out of it, but I was single-minded in my determination to slit my own wrists. I marched into the school office, waited courteously behind a mother who was signing her kid out sick, while my heart pounded in my chest, and found myself face to face with destiny. In between my stammer and spittle, I think I managed to squeak out that I thought group punishment was unfair. Sister Mercedes' eyes narrowed and, I think, turned red. She cocked her habit at a jaunty angle to her white hair. And what makes you so special, Mr. Petty, that you think you deserve to go outside and play while all your friends stay inside? No, there were others. I'm their champion. I'm their hero. They practically nominated me Pope just now in that classroom. How dare you try to sully so pure a comradeship as I have with my fellow classmates? I was practically carried into this office on the wings of companionship and civic pride. So steeled in the adoration of my fellow man, I replied approximately, I never spoke so eloquently. Get back to your classroom immediately. I'll be up in a minute. As soon as she entered the room, she demanded that I stand up. Mr. Petty thinks his punishment is unfair. He thinks he should be allowed to go out and play while the rest of you stay here in your classroom. Do any of you feel the same way? Cue crickets. I thought so. Do you know what that makes you, Mr. Petty? A parasite. Do you know what that means? A person who's taking a vow of poverty yet lives quite comfortably on the money squeezed out of her lower middle class congregation when the plate is passed every Sunday? Is what I should have said. No, was my actual reply. You should look it up, Mr. Petty. It perfectly describes you. And here I am years later on disability. I guess she had me nailed. But I learned some important lessons, character-building lessons that followed me throughout my life. Lessons like might is right, power is meant to be exploited, and fairness is a relative concept. And most importantly, if you plan on taking a stand on moral grounds, don't look over your shoulder. You're better off not knowing how few folks are back there.
Thank you. If you just joined us, you are listening to Between the Lines, and we're here with Brian C. Petty, a playwright, and he's just read, that was the first chapter?
That was the first story in Sister Mercedes and the Temple of Doom. It's what the entire ebook is named after, that first story.
You know, there's very few authors of whom I would say, I wish I'd written that, but I felt that a lot when I was like reading the whole ebook. I just really didn't want the experiences necessarily that you'd had.
You can't have one without the other.
You have to go through
12 years of Catholic school to be able to put the pen to paper.
Clearly an experience I'm glad I missed, actually. So this started as a blog. Now, you're a playwright, so why... First of all, when did you start it, and why a blog?
That's a good question. I started this in 2011. I had returned... I was between surgeries.
We should just explain.
Sure.
We're sort of jumping ahead yet, but you know, the health issue is a huge one and it runs throughout this book. So why don't you just explain?
Oh, sure. I'll give you the short version because the long version you don't want anything to do with. I've had a series of about 7 operations over past 13 years or so. I worked through many of them. Then about
worked.
I went back to my job in New York City, and
which was as
I worked for Prudential Securities in procurement, and then I moved on to a sales job. When I lost that job, I was working through this health issue for a long time until finally I was just ran to ground about. 4 or 5 years ago, I was working part-time in sales, and I just couldn't do it anymore. I went to become a manager at a store. They had already hired me, and I went to the training, and it was about a 6-hour day, and I came home, and I said to my wife, I feel like I'm leaking oil. I just can't, I don't have the strength to keep doing this. And of course, I found out later that some of my surgeries had not done what they were supposed to, and I was having problems as a result.
And these were surgeries to do what exactly?
Well, I had a full colectomy, which is they removed my colon. That was the first one. And then I had a series. Yeah, that was fun. You're asleep for all of them. That's the great part. You know, for about 2 hours or 8 hours, you get to be asleep. That's where all my problems stemmed from. And then the time during this blog, I was going through a particularly tough time physically. The blog gave me a great outlet to talk about that. In between my humorous posts, I tried to be funny and light and, you know, and sometimes political or, you know, whatever, wherever the mood struck me. But there were 5 or 6 that stood out that were definitely moments where my physical health was taking over what my thought process.
So you started this blog. Now, did you have an idea that you might want to do something with it, or did you just love doing it? Because you're really a playwright.
I am really a playwright, but as you know, as a playwright yourself, sometimes it comes easier than others. And while it wasn't coming easy, while I was focusing on some physical things, I wanted an outlet that would make me write, you know, that would force me to be on some kind of schedule. And I, you know, of course, I started like 4 times a week and it went down to 3 and 2, and now it's about once a month. But still, it's, you know, I feel like I have to get something out, and having a time frame really helped me. When I first started it, I said, one day I'm going to make a 99-cent Kindle book out of this, you know, and end up being $2.99. But other than that, it kind of worked out.
How did you get a readership for this?
Well, I bugged a lot of people. I used Facebook at the very beginning, and my wife is a great resource. I can post, you know, I need my leg is hanging off, someone please call 911, and no one will read it. But she can say, you know, what's your favorite color? And 200 people will respond to her. So I got a lot of followers through her folks, her high school friends. And then there were some hardcore fans of mine who I knew from playwriting who followed me into the blog world. And that was great. It's a self-published world these days. It really is. It's, you know, the days of handing your book over to a publisher and saying, you go find me an audience. Those days are over. You know, if you want your book reviewed, you got to send out 800 requests to get 20 reviews. That's the reality of the situation right now. On the positive side is I would have written this and had it stuck in my drawer and maybe never gotten it published had I gone that route. Self-publishing, if it's good, can be a great thing. But you have to have the goods in either way. If I put the book out there and everybody gave it 2 stars, then we wouldn't be having this conversation. I'd be like, don't talk about my book. But
yeah, you happen to have attracted a lot of really great reviews on Amazon and you've got 5 stars. And I also just wanted to interject a little and sort of introduce your wife, who of course is Mary Ellen, who features prominently in the e-book. And she just comes across as a saint, I have to say.
She will love hearing that. She will love hearing that because for the week leading up to the publication and the week after, all she could say to me was, don't talk to me. You called me a gas giant in print.
And I was this is true. But
there were other things. And it's so funny, depending on, how people perceive us or their own relationships. People either say, oh, you poor woman, you have to live with that guy. Or they say, oh, you poor guy, you have to live with that woman. But we're both...
I think you're a good team.
Yes, I think that's the truth. I think we're both perfectly suited for each other, warts and all. And that's probably why we ended up together. But she will love hearing that you said she comes across like a saint. I'm going to make sure she hears that.
But also, I mean, she is an established playwright as well, is she not?
She's more of an actor and a singer. Okay. She's put together some cabarets in her time. What she is, as far as writing goes, is my number one best editor for my work ever. Whenever I do anything, including this book, I run it by her first and have her unbiased opinion because it's always, always a way to help the work grow. She has a talent for it. As any writers in the audience, including yourself, you know, an editor is a valuable thing to have. Everybody with a keyboard has a voice these days. And what has happened, I think, is that there's a lot of everything. And there's not much to tell you before you dive into something, whether it's going to be quality or not. So to me, the way to try to put yourself above that fray is to make sure that you're producing quality work. And that's what I tried to do with. I was trying with my blog to say to myself, can I do this on a level that I would want to read? I want my friends to read. I want people that I know to read. And then when you open it up, that people who don't know me are going to say, wow, that was good, or that was funny, or that made me think, maybe this is a voice that I can follow. And that's kind of the same idea with the book, is to, it's a sink or swim thing. You send it out there into cyberspace, and if people react to it positively, then Meryl Streep is playing you in the movie. And if they don't, then they don't. It's very democratic these days. You know, nobody gets 5 stars just because they're Stephen King, or you have to earn it. No one knows your name before you go into this. So that's kind of what I'm trying to do right now, is get my name out there and get people in front of this book and thinking about it, so that maybe it would all open me up as far as a playwright and some of my other works that I've done are a little different.
Did you ever think about trying to get an agent and going the traditional publishing route?
I really didn't. I have, I think, 4 plays currently published, legitimate publishing houses. What I've found thus far, although I appreciate the opportunity that those publishing houses give me, nobody can promote your work the way you can promote your work. But most of the places that want to publish your work are small and have the same problem that I have. They have just with 800 other authors. The short answer is no. I didn't think this would fit with some of the places that were big enough, the promotion that was necessary. And I thought it was just quirky and funny enough to catch on as a sensation and maybe be one of those underground hits that maybe gets noticed down the road. You know, people reading the book is what I'm about.
And we're here with Brian C. Petty, and you're listening to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper, and we're going to take a short break. When we come back, I'm going to ask Brian to read another excerpt.
Well, it's not always raining. There'll be days like this. When there's no one complaining, there'll be days like this. When everything falls into place, like the flick of a switch. Oh, my mama told me, there'll be days like this. When you don't need to worry, there'll be days like this. When no one's in a hurry, there'll be days like this. When all the parts of the puzzle start to look like they do, then I must remember there'll be days like this. When you don't need an answer, there'll be days like this. When you don't need a chance, there'll be days.
You are listening to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper, and we're here with Brian C. Petty, playwright and blogger. And what are you're going to read as an excerpt? What are you going to read as?
Well, you mentioned my wife, Mary Ellen, and she is featured prominently in this selection. It's called At the Chinese Buffet with Lee Marvin. On our kids' birthdays, we allow them to pick whichever meals they want. My older son, Connor, turned 13 recently, and in those relatively few years, he has learned to play the system to the hilt. Somehow, Mary Ellen and I got roped into providing a breakfast at Burger King, followed by a trip to the Chinese buffet for lunch/dinner. I think in at least half of the contiguous United States, such a diet would be grounds to have my boys temporarily placed in foster care. If you happen to be one of those states' representatives, please come and get them as soon as possible. Mary Ellen took him to BK for a healthy breakfast of grease sticks with maple syrup and some kind of deep-fried, vaguely potato-like substance. He had two of those. I looked up the nutritional value of that combo one time on the back of a placemat. It said, "You're kidding, right?" These are the jokes, folks. Connor was in his newly teenaged glory, until about an hour later when he was face down in the couch, moaning that his stomach hurt so badly he wished it would just explode like an alien and end his suffering once and for all. Because it was his birthday, we didn't say, "I told you so." We decided to put off the trip to the buffet until 3 o'clock to give Con some time to recover. The rest of us hadn't poisoned ourselves with belly bombers, so we were getting hungry. Passing up Chinese food was not an option. So when the time came, Connor screwed his stomach to the sticking post and crawled into the back seat. He spent most of the time in the fetal position. With great gastronomical distress comes great responsibility. I'm not sure what hurt him more, his stomach woes or the fact that he was squandering this opportunity to participate in what was, for him, a culinary royal flush. How often does the opportunity arise to have whatever meal you want, no matter how bad it is for you? All right, how often when you were 13? Connor, like the rest of us in the family, is a foodie. He hasn't quite developed taste, but he knows what he likes. He's also a world-class planner of exactly the type of good time he wants to have. "Let's go to the park, get ice cream, see a movie, and play a game when we get home. Got home too late to play Monopoly? Now it's all ruined. Self-sabotaged again." So entering the holy land of a Chinese buffet and not being able to eat was tantamount to Tantalus never being able to reach that delicious, low-hanging fruit, only with chicken on a stick. Going to the Chinese restaurant was one of the highlights of my lower-middle-class childhood. It was rare, first of all. Most of the time we went when my mother had exhausted every possible scenario for fixing dinner, and payday was still a few days off. That or a super special occasion like when Skylab fell or someone managed to graduate. It was mysterious and wonderful. The red booths, the foreign music, the fish tank, the sharply dressed waiters who brought poo-poo platters. Actual fire right there on the table, rising out of magical blue goo. Now we're fed like pigs at a trough by servers who can hardly hide their disdain for us overfed fat bodies. I miss the waiters who went back to the kitchen to laugh at us. It was more noble somehow. We picked a seat far back in the restaurant in case Connor began to moan again. He lay down in a heap in the booth behind us, garnering a few double takes from the people on their way to the restroom. We told the waitress we were getting three meals for Marielle, Michael, and myself, and a maybe for Connor. We got Connor a Coke to sip on while the rest of us went on with the business of earning our servers disdain by becoming overfed fat bodies. Marielle bemoaned the fact that there were no crab legs, which didn't come out until 4 p.m. Like the gun in Act One, this will soon be important. As we neared the end of our meal, a miracle occurred. Connor's stomach rose from the dead like Lazarus. With the strength of 10 Grinches plus 2, he arose from his prone position, dusted himself off, and threw himself back into the fray that is the Chinese buffet. He was 13, damn it, and he would not be denied his birthright in soy sauce. Connor wanted himself some crab legs. See? I told you. Connor and Marielle have caused the stock of crab crutch companies to soar over the past 10 years. Give them a pile of crustacean limbs, a nutcracker, and some melted butter, and get out of the way. And disdainful servers were bringing them out by the truckload as we spoke. Somewhere a crab is trying to make a fist in protest and realizes he can't anymore. Connor's birthday was saved. Except, we paid for lunch, not dinner. And the buffet was being guarded by the formidable restaurant owner, who I'm sure made it her mission in life to allow not even one crab leg to be eaten by some conniving late lunch guest. We would never try such a tactic ourselves, because besides being morally wrong, it would involve knowing what time of day it is at any given moment. We're not that clever. But Connor wanted crab legs, and it was his birthday. Intrepid Marielle volunteered to make a run at the crab legs like Lee Marvin in The Dirty Dozen. If anyone made a fuss, she would explain that Connor wasn't feeling well when he came in, and now he would like to have dinner, so charge us the extra $2. Marielle has a way of expecting the rest of the world to be as reasonable as she is, which is why she takes on these missions instead of me. I'm certain everything will soon go to hell, and it usually does. My back was to the buffet, and I didn't watch. I did, however, casually remark to Connor that it would be funny if the owner said something to Mom. It wasn't. No sooner had the words escaped my mouth, I heard the owner raising her voice. That's for dinner, not lunch! I know, my son wasn't feeling well. Not lunch, you pay for lunch! I know we did, but my son didn't eat. No crab legs for dinner! Add it to my bill, lady, my son's eating crab legs. I was in hysterics. Proud, embarrassed hysterics. Marielle came back to the table with Connor's crab legs, began to shell them in an annoyed manner, and said, check the bill when it comes, we're paying for one dinner. Then the funniest, best part of the whole experience occurred. Marielle looked over my shoulder and found the owner wherever she was in the restaurant, made sure she wasn't looking, and surreptitiously snuck a piece of crab leg into her mouth with a look of pure, unadulterated rebellion. Take it out of my mouth, I dare you. Hell hath no fury like a woman denied crab legs. And you don't mess with Lee Marvin on her son's birthday.
One of the things that struck me when I was reading this is you make writing seem easy. Now it seems like it just kind of flows out of you, you know, whereas of course so many of the great writers have said writing, good writing, is rewriting and rewriting. And so do you rewrite?
What's the story? Yeah, of course I rewrite. Oh. You know, one of my favorite singers, Bruce Springsteen, they said, how do you get that live sound in the studio? How do you make it sound like you're just spontaneously making it up in the spur of the moment? And he said, we do it 30 times. That's how we do it. Now, this is a different type of voice than a playwriting voice. A playwriting voice, you have to think in terms of dialogue most of the time. And in this, you have to think more in terms of setting the moods, setting becomes more important. Where are we? What's happening? What's going to happen next?
What makes this so good is your voice.
Well, thank you. This is as close to as unadulterated a voice as I get. There's moments in my plays where maybe you could see the author behind the words. But I try in my plays to stay out of it. You know, it's the characters speaking. But with this, I could be the author. It's a forum where that's okay, where in fact it actually lends itself to the story. So that is a different type of writing, but it was very freeing and it did allow me to do some fun thing.
The other thing I wondered about was to what extent it's kind of like a form of therapy. Because you do have rather a lot of hardships in your life at times, it seems,
when, you know, other people could really get quite depressed. But as one reviewer said, you always have a very sort of optimistic, resilient voice.
It's that the kind of resilience that when you're at the end of the rope tying a knot that you have to have, where, you know, I have two kids. I'm not going to let go of the rope. You know, I got to keep hanging on somehow. And the wife and, you know, and a wonderful life that I've carved out. So I drive the car with the taped down trunk, and, you know, I'm constantly in debt, and I deal with a lot of rejection being a playwright. But I think there's enough of the great things that happen in life in here to balance that out. It's not all about, oh, this is another look what happened to this schlub this time. You know, there's enough of that family dynamic and the funny things that happen and the touching things that happen. I tried with this blog to be as completely honest as I could and not have any filter. That's why some, you know, now that I'm running into people who have read the book, I'm like, oh my God, you know everything. You know, now I know why you moved. Oh, okay. Yeah, it's kind of the backstory that you don't want to trouble anybody with. But if you can make people laugh at it, I think it's a great way to connect. It's gallows humor is something, it's not restricted to the Irish, but the Irish do it so darn well.
They do.
It's something that it was very much a part of my upbringing. It's very much a part of my marriage and family life. It's laugh to keep from crying type of thing.
When did you start writing?
I started writing in 1996. I was in my mid-20s, 26, 27. I had always written. I went to college. I had a specialization in writing, but it was mostly stories and nothing to do with playwriting. And I had an opportunity to fill an hour and a half slot on a stage. It was for a benefit for Art for AIDS. They said, find a one act that you can do. And I said, okay. And I looked at some one acts, but I didn't find anything that worked for me. And I said, why don't I just write it? In the way that you dive headlong into something without really knowing the pitfalls and the ramifications, there I was. I had a play, I had a cast, and we had a good show. I had found something, a voice that had been there but hadn't found its way out yet, and that was through playwriting.
And we are just going to take a quick break. You are listening to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. I'm here with playwright and blogger Brian C. Petty. And when we come back, we're going to talk a bit more about the playwriting side of Brian.
Childhood living is easy to do. The things that you wanted, I bought them for you. Yeah.
And you are listening to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. I'm here with playwright Brian C. Petty. Let's talk about your plays. What was the first one that you wrote?
Everything's Coming Up Roses was my first play, and it took place on an AIDS ward. Like I said, it was an Arts for AIDS benefit. And one of the characters was Sidney J. Stein, who was a very flamboyant, funny character in that play. You know, imagine a funny character on an AIDS ward, but that was who he was. That was what he was in that play, too. Subsequent to that, my first full-length play revolved around him. It was called Before the Parade Passes By. My latest play, I went back and revisited that character. And now he's helping runaways in New York City at a halfway house.
Is the play that you have opening in July
Yes.
in New York?
Okay. Yes, it's part of the Fresh Fruit Festival. It spotlights gay, transgender, lesbian characters and situations. And now we have a three-night run in July of this play with the original gentleman, Jim Pillmeyer, who played Sidney J. Stein way back in 1996.
But in fact, you write about quite a range of subjects. I mean, you also write a lot about your Irish background.
Yes, but the last time I was in New York was we read part of that play on your show.
Banshee.
Was Banshee. And that was the story of my uncle on my mother's side, which is the Irish side, the Sullivan side, which comes to play in the book as well, because there's a lot of that. That's the side of my family that I was much closer to growing up. So yes, there's Banshee. I wrote about it, which is Irish American. Next Year in Jerusalem is a Holocaust play.
Why AIDS? Why does that? And why the Holocaust for that matter?
Tackle
you know,
one.
I guess what I'm saying is, what is it that interests you in a subject? What are you looking for?
I think inherent dramatic opportunity is one part of it. And you can just say the Holocaust is such a huge thing. You know, you're not going to write the definitive Holocaust play. But if you tell one person's story, you can write a Holocaust play and you can add to the story, the overwhelming story. At the time, when I wrote that in 1999, there were a lot of people denying the Holocaust happened. And I felt it was something that needed to be captured. It's an elderly Holocaust victim who's at the center of that play, but it's a very personal story, is about losing his family and how he made it through, you know, one of the worst things that could happen to a person. This was an important story that I needed to tell. And most of the time, I don't write issue plays or anything. I don't hunt for, what's everybody talking about now? But something like the Holocaust or the AIDS crisis, which I've looked at from a lot of different ways, from being in an AIDS ward to another play I have takes place at a party where they're celebrating somebody becoming HIV positive, because things have changed to such a degree that now it's, oh, great, you got that out of the way. The difference between generations for the people who lived through the 80s and had friends and family members die, and the current generation who really, it's just an extended sickness to them. These issues don't go away. Part of a playwright's job is to respond to what's going on around him. And I don't have a plan necessarily. I got into writing to begin with through Art for AIDS, so it kind of lent itself to it. But after that, I really just follow wherever my muse takes me, to make it sound presumptuous.
What are you working on at the moment?
Funny you should ask. A one-act play that is about a relationship between a teenage girl and an older man. You know, hot buttons all over the place. I just to give you some background, I recently watched something on PBS about Philip Roth, who's, you know, one of the authors I respect greatly. And he said, our job isn't to judge as artists. He says, our job is to present the problem and let the audience judge. If you solve the problem for your readers, for your audience, you're doing them a disservice, and it's not really art. It's just a tidy bow, you know, on a gift. That's kind of where I'm coming from with this play. It's something that happens, and it's something that is a scourge in a way on our society. But how does it happen? How does it manifest itself? How do these relationships come to be? So those are the questions I'm asking, kind of withholding judgment. I mean, there's a great play called Wit. I'm sure you know, you're nodding.
Yes,
so you, I love it. Yes. And the it's been made into an HBO movie. It was a play about an end-term cancer patient.
And, which on the face of it, you'd think, oh God, how depressing, but it's a beautiful play.
And the author of that play, Margaret Edson.
Oh.
And she sent that play to every theater in the Dramatist Handbook, and they all said no. She had a friend who knew somebody in a Los Angeles theater who said, why don't you bring it there for a reading? Why not? They brought it there and became what it became. The overwhelming majority of what she got there was rejection because of the subject matter. It won the Pulitzer Prize, mm-hmm. and it's one of the most beautiful plays I've ever read. And part of our job is, as playwrights, is to not see the boundaries, not to push them over into, you know, with a hammer and bash them down necessarily, but to go past them without anybody noticing and say, I am going to write something about this, or I am going to write something about that.
Who else do you admire as a playwright? I know that in your blog you mentioned Tom Stoppard.
Tom Stoppard is a god to me. And it's just, like you were saying, the ease of writing. It just comes so trippingly off the tongue. I've been in a Stoppard play, as an actor, and it's such, get in there and grab it, you know, those kind of lines. He's one of the big ones. He's like the Shakespeare of our time. And I got to meet him. It's in the book. Another one who has a huge influence on me is Conor McPherson, who's written The Weir, among many other plays. He's an Irish playwright. He kind of opened up monologues and not having to worry about trying to be so fast and entertaining with everything. His plays are quieter and more intense and more about storytelling. I saw him, my son Connor is named after him. I saw his play The Weir when Mary Ellen was pregnant with Connor, and I said, I want to be able to do something like that. I don't want to be constrained by what is in vogue or what is, you know, we want puppets. We want, you know, it has to be 12 TVs going on at the same time. You know, there's a big push to move theater out of the realm of theater and make it TV in the theater. And some of those things are pushing boundaries of what theater should be. And some of them are losing, I think, the impetus of what theater can be, which is basically storytelling and basically characters and caring about what goes on that little, you know, 2x4 stage.
When I was reading the blog, the thing that I was thinking about was, oh, this would make quite a good sitcom. Sort of not exactly Modern Family, but not exactly Roseanne or the Brady Bunch, but something along those lines. Has anybody ever said that before?
Yes, actually, one of our fellow Playwright Lab members said, Brian, you need to read this out loud. You can't. I said, well, you got to wait. Anne's going to put me on the radio.
But that was another question, actually. Have you ever thought of doing stand-up with
I
this
thought about
trying
it.
To do performance?
The best, well, first of all, I'm going to need a nap after this, so I don't know how I'm
going to
do that.
Wasn't
that bad, you know, No. But, you know, with my energy level, you know, yeah. 1 o'clock in the morning in a CD bar. I don't know if I'm going to make it to one of the best observations I've heard about a blog. Why people write a blog? I went on to this guy's blog one time, and it said, "I'm practicing for the comedy routine I'll never do." And I thought that's really makes
good.
Sense. I got my timing down, but it's never going to leave this blog. I would love an opportunity like that. But again, that's a young man's game. If I can make you laugh sitting in the corner reading your Kindle, that's fine with me. I don't need to
settle for the Kindle.
Right, I don't need the applause right in my face. You know, I got other outlets for that.
Okay, Brian C. Petty, I just want to thank you so very much for being on Between the Lines.
Thank you for having me.
It's been great fun. And your play is
The Love Song of Sidney J. Stein, which a theater called The Wild Project. It's on 195 East 3rd Street. And it's going to be Friday the 12th at 9 p.m., Saturday the July 13th at 4:30, and Friday July 19th at 9 p.m.
And your blog, why don't you give your blog a plug?
Sure.
That's why we're here.
It's pettyplays.wordpress.com.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Anne.
Please stay tuned. You're listening to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. Next up, Kenneth Hamrick, the artistic director of the Catskill Mountain Foundation. My next guests are the Catskill Mountain Foundation's artistic director, Kenneth Hamrick, who's also a distinguished conductor and an award-winning harpsichordist, and later on a phone interview with dancer Christina Lynch Markham. Welcome to Between the Lines, Kenneth. How did the CMF get together with such a renowned company and person as Paul Taylor?
Well, the Catskill Mountain Foundation, in its development of a community outreach series of dance, actually has almost a 10 to 11 year history of presenting professional dance companies from the international professional community. This is actually going to be the second time the Paul Taylor Dance Company and the educational wing, the Taylor 2 Company, has visited the mountaintop alongside other notable dance companies such as Jose Limon, Alvin Ailey, Alyssa Monte, Jennifer Muller, and most recently, say, Flamenco Vivo, that has just gone wild with success, bringing dance into an underserved community and having people have it recognized as important in their lives.
And actually, before this interview started, we were talking about the Orpheum Performing Arts Centre itself.
Well, I think that that's a starting point to really answer your question about the new association with the Paul Taylor Dance Company, is that over these 10 years, in the range of performance spaces on the mountaintop, historical buildings that have been revived, rebrought to life for artistic purposes, the dance has been presented in a range of spaces. But it became known that we needed a really professional, top-rate dance music center. And what became involved in a multi-year project was the Orpheum Performing Arts Center. Been described as one of the most beautiful settings for dance with music, maybe perhaps in the country. It has a proscenium stage with a large professional scale dance floor, but teamed with that, architect Hugh Hardy was particular to develop a room with an acoustic for live music, so you could experience really the intricacies of dance with the music together. No recording, no amplification. We really do it the old-fashioned way, and we're finding it's quite successful.
The program is very much geared to local students, correct?
Well, we're working on multiple levels. The New York State Council on the Arts, their purpose is to enrich the lives of New York State citizens. And they, and along with the visionary leadership of the governor's office, have said, what is dance to a community? What is dance to educate the young people, even young children? So the role of a great American master and his company is to work with everyone, to inspire them not only to appreciate the dance being performed by the professionals, but to even learn to dance themselves and what that can mean in their own lives as artistic enrichment.
Now, as artistic director, how instrumental were you in getting Paul Taylor involved?
Well, partly that this residency is the first example of what has become known in the New York State Council on the Arts residencies in dance. That the New York State Council on the Arts said the role of the master companies is to go out as pioneers in taking their art to the people. And so a combination of the Taylor Company with the vision of New York State Council on the Arts saying they want to sponsor companies to go out and enrich the lives of New York State citizens. Also teamed with that is a new initiative originating from the governor's office, the Regional Economic Development Council, meaning that indirectly that the governor can be quoted from his State of the State address earlier this year saying, arts shall revive the Catskills. And so the idea of the Orpheum Performing Arts Center as part of the Catskill Mountain Foundation initiative for Arts on the Mountaintop to arise as a regional public multi-arts center, bringing together all of the arts to enrich the lives of the citizens in the region, but also as an attraction to bring people to our community to enjoy the beauty of the mountains, the beauty of the historic buildings, the beauty of the art forms, such as the recognition of the Paul Taylor choreographies as major American masterpieces. But what is unique for us, because of our dedication to music, and particularly historical music, because of our wonderful piano museum, is that suddenly you get to rediscover these American great masterpieces with a period instrument orchestra in the splendid setting of the Orpheum Theatre.
And I have to say, it is an absolutely gorgeous theatre. I was there last summer to hear Aaron Deal with the jazz programme, which was a packed house, and it was just a fabulous evening. Everyone went over across the road afterwards, and they're jammed till about 3 a.m. or something.
It's so part of our initiative to have a broad spectrum of the arts, the finest that we can bring to the mountaintop, to utilize these fine facilities, because all of a sudden, a building is nothing more than a piece of equipment to accomplish a program.
But this event on May 22nd, that's the kind of culmination of the whole festival. What would you like to tell us about that?
The vision of this kind of residency, saluting again the vision of New York State, to really say, how are we going to impact lives? Meaning that the Taylor II Company comes in advance 2 weeks to begin community outreach and education. What is a Paul Taylor choreography? What makes it interesting? What makes it uniquely Taylor? What makes it uniquely American? Coming with the full professional company, who is almost always on tour internationally, to perform major choreographies such as Kith and Kin, which is performed to a Mozart serenade, a chamber orchestra piece, Scudorama, which is a famous work of Paul Taylor's that's performed with an electronic soundscape by Clarence Jackson, and culminating with the newly revived Brandenburgs of Paul Taylor. Suddenly, by the 22nd of May, the audience, the community, the student, they have points of reference and relevance, how to appreciate it, and then we say on the 22nd that the audiences at large have the opportunity to experience this repertoire that is both communicative for the dance and the live music in a fantastic space.
What would you like our audience to know about this residency and the performance?
Having been a resident in various spots around the Catskills for the past 14 years, it's the magic of being here that you can explore the beauty of the landscape, the beauty of the setting of these historic buildings, and to have a direct, even tactile, you can go up and meet a Paul Taylor dancer and experience the real art forms in a very special way that is not available anywhere else in this country. But also, it's the opportunity to perform with the music on the historical instruments, as well as experience the art form that impacts people's lives directly, because we find these Catskill audiences, at least myself speaking, I think they're among the best in the world.
And on that note, once again, it's the May 22nd performance of the Paul Taylor Dance Company. And where can people get tickets? Where can they find out about
it? There's more information on www.catskillmountmtn.org.
Kenneth Hamrick, the Artistic Director of the Catskill Mountain Foundation, I'd just like to thank you so very much for being on Between the Lines. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing the performance.
Thank you, Anne. It's been a pleasure to be here.
And please don't go anywhere. We will be right back with dancer Christina Lynch Markham.
Thank you.
now, here's Paul Taylor dancer Christina Lynch Markham. So you're with Paul Taylor too. Exactly what is the difference between the Paul Taylor Dance Company and Paul Taylor too?
The second company was actually modeled by the original company that Paul created, and it's a 6-member company, and then we have a rehearsal director and a production manager, and we travel all over America and also internationally as well, and we try to hit as many small towns and also big towns, and we show them what American modern dance is, and we teach them some form of the style and technique based on their technique level themselves, and then we have a performance for them. So the only difference really is that there's 6 of us versus 16, and because we're so much tinier, people-wise, we can dance in any venue, and also we're such master teachers that we can teach any age group and any ability and background as well.
So it's kind of like community dance. It's bringing dance to the people.
It really is, and that's what's so special about the second company, because we will go to a senior citizen's home, and we have a class that we teach them while they're sitting down, and also we put on a little mini performance, and then they can clap and sing along with us. We've also, because of not that many people, we've danced actually in a hospital, and we've danced in the hallways for people that were undergoing treatment. You give us a musical player, and we will dance in any stage, non-stage, on grass, in a hallway. It's really quite magnificent, just to help brighten a person's day and just help them to see a different way of dancing and a different way of moving and how to be active.
And I understand that Paul Taylor actually picked you himself to come and do this interview.
Yes, he did. It's quite an exciting time for me, because not only am I in the second company right now, Tannersville will actually be my last residency as a Taylor 2 member, because I'll be joining the main company starting in June.
And what's it been like so far? I mean, what are the Catskill kids like to work with?
The students that we'll be working with, they range from pre-professionals, which will have an intensive, in which the pre-professionals can come and study with us, and they can see what it's like to be a dancer in a New York City company, because we'll teach them technique, and then we'll also teach them repertory. Along with that, we'll be working with various dance studios as well, and then teaching the Taylor style and trying to help them with the repertory, and then we're also going to be going to various schools to perform lecture demonstrations, in which our rehearsal director will explain the history and the meaning of the many dances that we will be performing, and also show them how we work out, how we warm our bodies, and then that way it's not a scary thing to see live dance.
What's Paul Taylor like to work with?
He is a very, very sweet man, and I'm very excited to work with him even closer. He is so into gesture. Whenever he comes and watches the rehearsal with us, he will pick a very little detail that sometimes does get lost in the shuffle of things when you're trying to do all these big legs and turns, and that's what's so amazing to me, because he will always spot it, and he will always tell you of how to make it better. And that's what really drew me to the company, is because of the interpersonal relationships that each dancer has with each other. And it's not the big legs and the turns and the leaps, but it's the simple hand gesture. He can coach you on how you can hold a person's hand, and it can take about 10 to 15 minutes until you get it just right because of the human quality.
Indeed, and he's clearly still so very vigorous and creative.
Oh, yes, he is. He is starting to make, I might be saying the wrong number, but I think he's starting to make his 139th piece, and he's still going strong, and he is very much a part of the rehearsal process. He is not going to be slowing down anytime soon. I have to say, for me, I believe that everyone should try a dance class at least one time in their life, because, you know, sometimes the word can't really can be a huge roadblock in your mind. Go and dance, because it really changes your feeling. It also, it's a form of exercise, and it's great for the mind, and also you get to experience music at the same time. It's a great way to stay healthy and fit, and you might really like it.
Christina Lynch Markham, thank you so much for being on Between the Lines. It's been absolutely delightful talking to you, and I wish you great success with your career.
Thank you so much.
And the music you were listening to was Van Morrison's Days Like This and Lucinda Williams and Elvis Costello's Wild Horses. The opening of Handel's Concerto Grosso, Opus 3 G Major, and a brief symphonia from Bach's Cantata No. 182.
And you have been listening to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. And thanks, as always, for listening.